This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, and this morning for Catherine Cruz. Housing is a challenge across the state. There's affordability and availability. Much of the recent attention is focused on rules and regulations surrounding short-term vacation rentals, but there's another piece to the housing story, especially on Oahu. It's all about those darkened homes and condos around the island, and it's an issue that's captured the attention of Honolulu city leaders. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has more on a proposal that could reduce the number of vacant properties and also bring in some revenue for the government.
More than 12% of the housing stock in urban Honolulu is vacant, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. That works out to more than 30,000 units.
Many of our housing units are being bought by folks offshore for speculation or second homes.
Standing within eyesight of several largely vacant Kaka'ako condos, Mayor Kirk Caldwell suggested a remedy during his annual State of the City address last month. He's working with the City Council on a bill
that would impose a vacancy fee for units that sit empty for long periods of time.
Caldwell got that idea from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Between 2014 and 2016, there was a giant run-up in prices.
Tom Davidoff is the director of the Center for Urban Economics and Real Estate at the University of British Columbia.
Like Hawaii, Vancouver is a place with high amenity and limited land on which to build. So when demand grows, prices tend to rise. There was a perception that a lot of the growth in demand from 14 to 16 was affluent buyers, many from overseas, who were leaving homes empty.
Davidoff and his colleagues helped write a tax on speculation, but Vancouver lawmakers also passed a 1% surcharge on properties left vacant for at least 6 months a year. About 1.5% of homes have been voluntarily reported as empty, resulting in a revenue windfall of about $30 million for the city. As for the housing market,
with the empty homes tax and another suite of taxes targeted at out-of-town buyers, it is true that the Vancouver housing market is now quite weak and has seen price declines across the board, but particularly among high-end homes.
Davidoff cautions that outcome may not be solely the result of the new taxes. He also warned that Honolulu's tourism-dependent economy may be more at risk for side effects of a vacancy tax. But overall,
so far, I would say certainly the outcome in British Columbia has been an A or A plus.
Before the idea can earn a grade in Honolulu, it would first have to be passed by the City Council. I'm Ryan Finnerty for Hawaii Public Radio.
And Ryan joins us in the studio for a little bit more on this story. Ryan, you wrapped up by saying this is something that needs to come from the Honolulu City Council. We'll get back to that. But first, take us back to the big picture of Vancouver and how prices changed there.
Yeah, so Bill, Vancouver is considered, for those who don't know, one of the most expensive cities in Canada, akin to, you know, a New York or an LA for Americans. And if you look at the data, the Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver shows that from the 1970s on, prices rose pretty gradually for about 30 years. They about doubled between the mid-1970s and the early 2000s, so about what you would expect, ending in the early 2000s with the average sale price for a detached home about $400,000. But beginning around 2003, they started to rise a lot faster. They doubled again in just 4 years, hitting the $800,000 for the average sale price of that same home. And we heard Tom Davidoff say in that piece that the rate of growth picked up even more around the next couple of years, peaking in 2016, where it reached a high. The average sale price reached $1.8 million Canadian, average sale price for a detached home in the Vancouver area, which works out to be about $1.4 million US. So even well above what we're seeing in Hawaii currently. And we have a graph that shows that data with this original story at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. But it pretty much shows that after 2016, there's a marked decline in price, actually, bottoming out around $1 million US at the beginning of this year, 2019. And as Tom said, much of those declines happened at the high end of the market.
And that's an interesting point, trimming the high end of the market a little bit. Often there's not a single cause that can be attributed, but some point to a combination of policies here.
Yeah, and that was what Tom said when I spoke with him. He hesitated to say that these two taxes were solely the to be credited for the kind of the turn in the market. Mm-hmm. He said the Canadian federal government also tightened its lending practices. So just like in the U.S., a lot of home mortgages do come from the federal government in some form. So there was a tightening of that lending around the same time, which may have contributed to a decline in demand. But there were also these taxes, the speculation tax that Tom helped write, and then this empty homes tax. And so he said that there is a belief that those contributed in large part to the decline in housing prices in Vancouver. But one thing he told me is that there's a risk for municipalities, for cities that are based in a tourism economy, for pursuing this type of strategy. And here's what he said.
Well, you know, we originally designed the so-called BC Housing Affordability Fund that became the speculation tax to allow municipalities to opt in or out. And we thought tourism-dominated municipalities might not want to be in the program because, of course, you don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. Now, Hawaii is a bit of a schlep from the U.S., and the statistic I don't know, but I think the government ought to be considering, is how reliant is the tourism economy on affluent people from out of town who, you know, don't occupy a place full time or rent it out to locals, you know, between Airbnb or part-time use vacation homes or timeshares. I think obviously the government would want to give serious thought to whether you're going to chase away an important part of the tourism business. That said, it might cause the hotel industry to expand to take that place. People can pay higher property taxes, of course. You know, I don't think the demand for homes will disappear in Hawaii, but certainly prices paid would fall.
So some interesting stuff there, as we've heard a lot the last couple of weeks with the debate over vacation rentals and short-term rentals. That was one of the big arguments against curtailing it, was that there'd be a negative economic impact. And so that's kind of what Tom is saying there. If you tax that inventory, basically, if it goes off the market, it could hurt the broader economy. One thing I learned in covering short-term rentals is that works out to be, by most estimates, about 15% of Hawaii's tourists are staying in some kind of short-term rental. So significant, but far from the majority. So perhaps that concern of Tom's is not as significant as it could be somewhere else.
It's relative to, again, in terms of the complications of the local economy, and it's different each place. But back to some of the starting points of where you began in terms of the vacancy rate in Honolulu. I mean, that's an eye-popping statistic for buildings and condo units standing empty.
Yeah, 30,000 according to the Census Bureau. That's using the congressional district, so CD Hawaii District 1, which is urban Honolulu. That works out to be about 12% of the housing stock in that area. Less if you go island-wide, it drops down to like a 5 or a 7%, which makes sense because a lot of these empty units are condos, we think. But still, you know, very significant either way you look at it. And one of the things Tom said is that the root cause of a lot of that is low property taxes. And that kind of makes sense because if the taxes are low, it's a low cost investment for someone from elsewhere in the United States or a foreign country to buy a really expensive property here. They're paying relatively low tax, less than 0.5% usually in the property taxes. And so he said, Tom said, from an academic perspective, the best way to really address this problem of speculation and empty homes is to raise property taxes and then cut taxes that really increase the cost of living for residents of Hawaii. And that would make buying investment property much less attractive. But he acknowledged that that's not always a political reality.
The problem with that is, of course, is that older homeowners are a very important part of politics. And so getting that fundamental tax reform done to get a more efficient economy that doesn't reward people just for buying real estate in a market where people would buy it anyway, but actually encourage people to make a living and be able to afford housing with their high take-home wages. That's a sensible tax reform. The problem is it's hard politically. The reason we did the BC Housing Affordability Fund instead of just a broad-based property tax increase is the politics. So to the extent these taxes are a politically feasible way to shift the tax burden from locals making a living to people who buy property, whether they live in Hawaii or not, I think that would be quite sensible.
So interesting. So you're back to where you were earlier on this, up to the Honolulu City Council. And what about the politics on this?
Yeah, I mean, as everybody kind of knows, raising property taxes, I think, as you once described it, the third rail of Hawaii politics. Mm-hmm. So not likely to see that happen. That's kind of where this comes in, much as it did in Vancouver. Mayor Caldwell said in his State of the City address that he did have some buy-in from Honolulu Council Chair Ikaika Anderson for this idea. The council's obviously been preoccupied addressing short-term rental legislation, which they voted on Monday to approve. So maybe this is something we'll see them take up later on this summer. It does seem like there's an appetite for addressing this type of housing issue, but so we'll just have to see.
Interesting, though, in terms of incentivizing behavior and trying to get ideas from outside as well as just here in the islands.
Yeah, and successful ideas from the looks of it.
Exactly. All right. HPR's Ryan Finnerty. Thanks for coming along with that.
Sure thing, Bill.
You're at the store and you see a good deal on shoes. If the shoes are frumpy, you say,
oh, sweatshop labor is wrong. I don't like sweatshop labor. I don't approve.
But if the shoes are cute,
oh, it's okay because people need jobs or companies need to make money.
This week on Hidden Brain, how our choices as consumers express and sometimes contradict our values.
This evening at 7, right after Says You.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Have you visited your local public library lately? For today's quiz, we're diving into the history of our public library system. Hawaii's statewide library system has more than 51 branches across 6 islands, but it all started with one building. Our first public library, the Library of Hawaii, opened on February 1st, 1913 in downtown Honolulu, where it still stands today. It offered more than 30,000 volumes to residents of Honolulu, including several works from the personal collections of King Kalakaua, Queen Kapilani, Queen Emma, Princess Bernice Paʻaohe Bishop. The building cost $127,000 to construct. That's more than $3.2 million in today's dollars. The territorial legislature contributed $27,000 to the library's construction, but the majority of the cost was covered by one individual. And for today's quiz, we want to know what philanthropist donated $100,000 to construct the Library of Hawaii. You can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, this is Jose Fajardo, President and General Manager at Hawaii Public Radio. If HPR is a part of your daily routine, isn't it time to make a commitment and become a member of the station? New members are so important to helping HPR grow and give you more of the programs that you already know and love. So why not take 2 minutes and become a member today at $10 a month or any amount that works for you? Just go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Each new member really does help, and thanks.
Thank you. Next week, we'll bring a kind of a milestone to the American political discussion, kind of an early one. The Democrats will be holding their first two presidential candidate debates. It'll be spread out over two nights because there are so many people running. But there's a lot more to this developing story, and it starts with the voters. Our contributing editor, Neil Milner, has been looking at some research that puts some of the politics in a different light, and he joins us this morning for the long view. And, Neil, what you've been looking at goes beyond the horse race aspect of simply looking at how different candidates are doing with support.
Yes, I'm looking at one study in particular, and then we'll talk about another one that looks more at what the voters are thinking about, particularly in regard to how they see the economy. And the big study is done by the Democracy Fund's Voter Study Group, which has a sample, it's a nonpartisan operation, sample of 7,000 voters, which is even more than the number of candidates that we have running for office.
That's a pretty sizable sample.
Very big sample. And it lets them do some very different things. So they look at how voters think about the economy, not just whether they think it's getting better or worse, but various other things, and look at political parties. So what they find out at this stage, and this is why it's important, because at this stage the notion of who's going to get the Democratic nomination is much more fluid, much harder to discover. Many things can happen. The voters' views about the economy, and particularly their narratives about why people are poor and why people are rich, is a much more stable factor. And we know that the economy is an important factor in determining how people vote. An important, not the important.
Sure.
We'll get back to that. So they find a couple of interesting things. One of the things they find is that Democratic voters are much more unified on economic policies than Republicans. Democratic voters, all the way from people making not much money, $40,000, to people making $200,000, maybe even more, tend to share the same approval of progressive economic policies, a higher minimum wage, more medical care, all those kinds of things. Republicans are more split. There's a group of Republicans, if you look at how they see the thing, a heavy majority of the Republicans take a more conservative position, the traditional Republican position. But 20% of Republicans voters, and they tend to be poorer, take a position on the economy that's much closer to the Democratic position of the Democratic voters than the Republicans. So they're much less unified, and the unity breaks down according to social class and income. So that's the first fundamental thing that they find before we even get into the question of how they think about the stories they tell about economics and what difference that makes.
And interesting, by the way, that split comes at the lower end of the income scale.
Yes, it does. And that shouldn't be too surprising, because there was certainly some of that in the 2016 presidential race. It wasn't just about very poor people, but the switchers tended to be people who were not as well off. The overwhelming number of Republicans voted for Trump. You had these switchers who switched over. So when you look at stories, how do people describe the economy? They ask them the value of wealthy people, why some people are poor, some people are rich. Democrats are very unified in talking about structural factors to some extent outside the control of individuals. Republicans tell a story that emphasizes individual willfulness, individual initiative, and so on. Again, though, you find Republicans more split on this than Democrats. And so when you look at these kind of narratives, what they also find is if you look at how these people vote and how they say they would be likely to vote in 2020, when you compare, you take a generic Democrat, they just say a Democratic candidate, a Republican candidate, Trump, and undecided, your view of economic policies tends to be consistent with whether you vote Democratic or Republican. But here's that little shift again. You have the percentage of Republicans who take on a kind of left-wing story, the progressive economic story. There is a larger portion of those that switch over than Democrats. who take on a Republican story. So there's that. So that's the kind of context to think about the bigger issue in the 2020 campaign about the economy, which is it really the economy stupid?
Right, from the famous Clinton line. Right.
And the answer is sometimes yeah and sometimes no, but that's what we can talk about.
But it's also that idea of creating a narrative around that. And it,
yes.
I mean, that makes me go back a lot further than Clinton. It was, I think it was 1928 in Hoover's campaign of a chicken in every pot.
Yes.
You know, sort of, think in later years, Reagan's reelection and it's mourning in America. I mean, again, thematic
or
ideas.
Or the welfare queen story.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, they intuited what we now know scientifically, and that is that people conceptualize their world through narratives mm-hmm. and through stories. And so it's not surprising that people have these kind of narratives about why people are rich, why people are poor, what's the value of wealthy people, in addition to the kind of surfacey question about do you think the economy is good or bad, or is it getting worse or is it getting better? What you find, though, that's different this time, we think, is the relationship is Donald Trump.
Mm.
Okay, because what you have now, when you look at the role of the economy in the 2020 election, is you have an economy that, by lots of indications, is doing very well. Certainly well enough so under normal circumstances that would score a lot of points in favor of an incumbent president. But at the same time, you have a president who has historically low approval ratings. And so you really have – so if you look at forecasting models about who's going to win 2020, and these things are pretty good.
Mm.
They're not infallible, but they're pretty good. The models that emphasize the economic fundamentals
mm-hmm.
Have Trump winning. The models that emphasize political fundamentals have Trump losing.
Political fundamentals being basically approval ratings.
Well, that's certainly one of the ratings. Mm. And certainly at the center of an economic fundamental is the economy, the unemployment rate,
sure,
whatever.
GDP.
Okay. So what you really have that you're going to see, and the candidates and the Democratic Party sort of reflects this, is you've got these two poles to deal with here. How much of it do you want to emphasize the economy?
Hmm.
And the Republicans are after Trump all the time to say more about the economy, probably because they think the economy is strong, and also because Trump gets himself, you know, wanders away when he and says things that a lot of Republicans would prefer him not to say. Now, there is an interesting poll that was just done by a very reputable operation in Wisconsin that tried to look more closely at how these two things are playing out. And Wisconsin is a bellwether state. Wisconsin was a state that surprisingly went for Trump. It's a highly partisan state. It's very partisan in the sense that it's an even state, but
mm-hmm.
It goes back and forth. So what you found in that poll is that most of the time when you poll people about the presidential races, the president's approval rating, Obama's as an example here, is very highly correlated with what people think about the economy.
Right.
Trump is very different. There's a huge disparity between approval rating for Trump, which is relatively low, and the economy, which is relatively high. So that, again, suggests that you have a very special situation here where you have a candidate who is has a strong base, but who is unpopular in lots of ways.
So, again, I might say at that point you're back on both sides to that creation of the narrative. Tell me a
yes.
story.
Oh, yeah.
What is the story that's going to pull this together, either from the GOP side in terms of in favor and unifying this, or from the Democrats' side as well to pull together the story that pulls that down?
I think that's right. Let's talk about the Democratic side for a second because of those debates coming up.
Hmm.
Listen to see the extent to which they talk about each of those. Joe Biden spends a lot of time when he's doing it really going after Trump. But most of these other candidates, and I think Biden is like that too, listen for the balance. Listen to the extent to which they're talking about a fairer economy, a better economy, and listen to the extent to which they attack Trump for his character and so on. And I think the Democrats are really feeling their way into this. And in fact, so are the Republicans, because Trump is in many ways a one-off. Even for the Republicans who voted for him, he's a different kind of candidate who poses certain kind of dangers for the Republicans also. But I think that's a way, if you're going to listen to all these people talk for two consecutive days, that's one of the filters you can use.
Look for the nuance in the political dialogue.
Oh,
all right,
God,
thanks,
nuance.
Neil.
Yes, you're welcome.
Good luck with that.
Yes.
Neil Milner is retired professor of political science at UH Manoa and joins us regularly with his thoughts on the long view.
Aloha, I'm Mike Wyatt from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the program, we talked about housing and absentee owners. We're also continuing to take a different kind of a look at part of the homeless situation in Hawaii, with a very specific look at Honolulu's neighborhood of Kaka'ako. HBR's Noe Tanigao has been spending time there talking with a number of people and joins us with more now.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to bring this to you, Bill. Earlier this week, we met Aura Reyes. You remember? She's a certified nurse's aide. She was also working at TSA when she lost her housing. In fact, she continued working those two jobs for years after that. But Aura got low-income housing just last year, 7 years after she filed for emergency family housing with HUD. And let's just jump into her story. Aura spent all those years without permanent shelter.
And before we came on the street, I used to be, I go get a job, da, 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 da. But oh my God, my first night on the street was just like, Dad, what do I do? What are we gonna do? He's just really calm about everything and don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. And he's been really resourceful. We started off probably Chinatown, that area first. Makiki, some people out here are like, oh, what, you know, more clothes? Oh, I get some clothes. And then they go in their stuff and they come out and they bring out some clothes. Oh, you need shoes, what, you get sandals, you get slippers, you need this, you need hygiene, you need all these people. I didn't even know these people.
What's it like here in the morning?
What you mean, like?
Like, what's it
morning,
like?
When people wake up,
yeah.
People go sleep in the morning. Nobody wants to come out at night, in the morning time. Sun is up, the people are out. I know I did. I tried to stay hidden. You don't want to be seen, especially outside your homeless camp, by the public, by people you knew.
Oh, so what do?
So a lot of times people just organize their stuff in their house, go to the shower, maybe wash some clothes or whatever. But you have a lot of people here that have jobs. So in the morning they get up and they're gone, they go to work. A lot of people, believe it or not, have real jobs.
They have state jobs, service jobs, lots of fishermen, Aura said, laborers, and a lot of people working two jobs, as she did. I wanted to introduce you to someone else too, Bill. John Montanona. He was a line cook. He worked at Nick's Fish Market, Brew Moon. Then he went on to Michelle's, but he lost that job when the brunch service failed when business was going down. He used to fish with his friends here at Kaka'ako, so he felt safe in this Kaka'ako Park area. He's been unsheltered for over a decade. Now, John is a little hard to understand, Bill, but I really wanted to give you just a brief sense of him.
A lot of new people come out here. We don't know who do.
I know.
John, we get the water from you. John, you get stove, you know, and I have all those things. You need anything. I'll provide it if I can. You need something? I tell people 80-90% of the time you come to me, so I guarantee you I get it. They dig it in their pockets. No, no, no. People can use it, I grab it.
what's amazing, how many people who have so much would make an offer like that?
So, and what he was saying, just as you say, hard to understand, mm-hmm. but he was saying that he had things that he could help people with if they came to him?
Whatever you need. Mm. He said 80, 90% of the time he will have it. He's talking about tools. He's talking about nuts, bolts, hammers, can openers. You know what? People always go to his place to eat because he used to be a cook. People drop off food at his place. They expect him to cook. He's always got a stove. Anytime you need spices, people go over there. And you know what? In fact, he said to me, he says to everyone, anytime you like, come house eat. No matter what time, day or night, come house. And I tell you, I feel a little different in Honolulu now. I know I can go there and have a meal. You know, John would always do that. He's kind of amazing to be around. Not judging, you know, when you look in his eyes. It's really something. Meanwhile, there in Kaka'ako, the 2019 point-in-time count showed 621 unsheltered. That's downtown to Kaka'ako. That's the largest concentration on Oahu, 26% of our total. And we have people across the state racking their brains over what to do about this unsheltered homeless situation. In Kaka'ako, several people just up and tried something. Here's Aura.
Okay, Alani, James, Kathy, they came up to Mother Waldron beginning of last year, and they had the talk story. So they would come, and they want whoever was out there, come. They would just want a talk story. They wanted to find out what was going on with the people. Why were people not leaving? Why were people not accepting the help or going into shelter? Like, what can people do to change things?
What do you think about that approach, Bill?
I'm curious what the answers were.
Yeah. I mean, those are things we wonder as we're walking around town. We just never stop and get to ask anybody. I mean, this is like the ultimate DIY grassroots approach to understanding the problem is what they really are trying to do. That was Alani Apio, James Koshiba, Kathy Kawano-Ching, with others. They kind of operate as a loose organization called Hui Aloha. And the thing is, they kept at it. Every Saturday, they meet and continue to meet there in Kaka'ako at the park there that fronts Ala Moana Boulevard. They meet and the community started taking chances themselves. They started believing that something could happen. Ora Reyes, John Kaulupali, John Mantanona, and others banded together under this name, Kapoe o Kaka'ako. They started cleanups, they met with area businesses, and I talked with two members of the Kaka'ako Neighborhood Board, Lynn Mariano and Ryan Tam, chair of the board. Here's Ryan Tam.
Our neighborhood board actually first got engaged in this issue a few months ago when John Kaulupali, one of the leaders of the Kapoe o Kaka'ako houseless community, actually came to one of our board meetings. He introduced himself and described their efforts to build a community at the Makai Gateway Park. He described their weekly service projects to clean up the area around the park and how they, as houseless people, were forging relationships with each other and actually working to police themselves and watch out for each other. Our board was really impressed by what they were doing. One of the lessons that I took away from all this was that they actually needed human relationships to heal, to come together, get a sense of community and security. And that was actually what they needed to go to the next step of getting off the street and into services, into shelters. When we first talked to them, they had about 40 people who had committed to move out there. And then a few weeks later, they had actually gotten 80 people to sign up. It was also really encouraging to see the volunteers from Hui Aloha work to help them come together like this, treating the houseless as people and not just as a number that needed to be matched up with a bed in a shelter. You know, that's a strategy at least worth trying, right? About 2 weeks ago, the city swept the Makai Gateway Park and the houseless community started to scatter and disintegrate. Our neighborhood board is just trying to help out. We're just trying to be part of the solution. It's not just about getting them out of a specific place. After the city swept the Makai Gateway Park, for example, we started seeing more houseless people up for the Mauka over by Sheridan Park and King Street. Of course, the residents in those neighborhoods weren't happy about this at all. So it's a really complex issue and something that we see happening again and again throughout the island.
Bill, that's one perspective. What's happening now is that there may be a move ahead for Kapo'e o Kaka'ako members. The idea is to transplant the community they now have to a plot of land where they can live kauhale style, style of traditional Hawaiian homes that are like a compound with different hale for cooking, eating, sleeping, stuff like that. It's the kind of community that Pu'u Honua o Waianae is trying to pull together. And out there in Waianae right now, private donors are offering $300,000 toward a new settlement for them if Pu'u Honua o Waianae can match that. Crowdsourcing is underway right now at alohaliveshere.org. You can find out a lot more about all of this right there.
And a lot of questions in terms of where these actions go next, mm-hmm. and in terms of land itself and in terms of those who live in areas where homelessness now, as you said, 26% concentration in terms of Kaka'ako and downtown Honolulu. Certainly a lot to keep an eye on, but also some things happening under the surface, perhaps.
New ideas are happening.
All right. Noe Tanigawa, she covers arts and culture at HPR, also does some other stories. You can find them all at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
This week on Says You.
I don't know, what do you have to do in order to get a visit from the stork? I don't understand.
Please, not in front of the children.
Oh. A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner. Says You.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
For today's quiz, we wanted to know what philanthropist funded the construction of the Library of Hawaii. The gentleman in question never set foot in Hawaii. In fact, he was born nearly 7,000 miles away in Fife, Scotland. Need another hint? In the late 19th century, he led the expansion of the United States steel industry, becoming one of the richest men in American history. In the last years of his life, however, he donated nearly 90% of his fortune to philanthropic causes. You might be nodding your head in recognition at this point. It was Scottish-American industrialist and business magnate Andrew Carnegie who donated $100,000 to start the Library of Hawaii. It was one of the 2,500 libraries that Carnegie personally funded. There's a Carnegie Library in nearly every state, with the exception of Alaska and Delaware. They are also in 13 other countries around the world. Many Carnegie libraries, including the Library of Hawaii, can be identified by their front columns near the entrance of the building. And we had a winner on that, Kathy and Kailua. She's on the board of the Friends of the Library, so knew that. And also mentions with a reminder that this weekend, book sale, Friends of the Library, McKinley High School. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Here in Hawaii, the Pacific Ocean is our neighborhood, and so much more than that. Along with oceans and waterways around the world, the Pacific Ocean is also plagued by pollution, and particularly by plastics. You may be familiar with the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, also known as the Pacific Gyre or the North Pacific Subtropical Convergence Zone. Located halfway between Hawaii and California, it's the largest of five offshore plastic accumulation zones in the world's oceans. The nonprofit group Ocean Voyages Institute just returned from a 25-day cleanup mission of that area, hauling away more than 35 tons of fishing nets and consumer plastics. Mary Crowley is the founder and executive director of that group, and she joins us now. Mary, thanks for coming in.
Oh, well, it's such a pleasure to be here and such a pleasure to be in Hawaii.
Personally, you did not go on this particular voyage, but you have in the past. a lot of us have seen pictures of this plastic gyre, the garbage patch. But to be there in the midst of that, what's that like when you come up on that in the ocean?
If you love the ocean like I do, and I know most people in Hawaii do, it's terrible. I mean, because you're in what's beautiful, pristine wilderness, deep ocean, and then suddenly you can be surrounded by our garbage that doesn't belong there and that is very destructive to the ocean in general and to the animal life within the ocean and to the reefs and everything.
Your first trip there was 2009, so a decade you've been involved in this. What's changed over that time?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the crew on board the ships was out with me on our second expedition in 2010, and she felt that this time there was just a lot more debris.
Mm.
But it's hard to say because the gyre area is constantly changing in size and in position.
And impacted by currents and by wind as well, yes?
Exactly. And, you know, part of this mission that we'd been preparing for over a year was having vessels of opportunity take out satellite tags we'd created. So, you know, any vessel doesn't have the capacity to pick up these nets.
Tons of nets.
But they do have the capacity to tag it. And then we get to follow its location, which teaches us more about debris distribution in the Pacific, and which also enables us to direct our cleanup ship directly to certain nets and trackers. And we're still proving this, but from my own experiences in the gyre, where we would find one net, we would frequently find others in that immediate, you know, 5 to 10 mile range. And so on this mission, they would go to find a tracker, and then we would have people in the crow's nest on the sailing vessel and people flying drones in search patterns, finding more nets. And we were, you know, close by to one of our trackers and nets. They found a 5-ton ball of nets. And so, you know, which is probably a dozen nets rolled up together. And those are real monsters in terms of killing, you know, they call them ghost nets because they continue fishing and killing. And when they come against a reef, they'll smother a reef and kill that too. So,
and it's also, it's not just on the surface. I mean, what you see on the surface is there and is spread out, of course, but it also goes down into the ocean itself.
Exactly. I mean, you really can't tell the size of what you're ready to tag or pick up and remove unless you get in the water with it and are able to free dive and see how far down it goes and how much there is in the water.
And this, just the massive size of this involved, what do? With the satellite technology, you locate it, you zero in, you triangulate, you find a position, you find this is where it is. This is not just taking out the trash in a simple sense. What do you do with that? How does that work?
Well, you know, we were particularly honored to be working with the sailing cargo ship Kauai this year. And we hope to work with them next year for a 3-month period to do a more extensive cleanup, because their crew is used to operating out of Honolulu, going down to the Line Islands, the Cook Islands, all small island groups, and delivering cargo. So they're used to loading and unloading significant weight. And the crew on board included, I think, six people from Kiribati. They were all of the crew on board, but they were very hard workers. So people would dive down and put straps under the net and be part of lifting the net so it could be gradually pulled on board. So their cargo experience, loading and unloading, allowed them to be uniquely skilled at picking up nets. And they found maybe three nets that were in the 5 to 8 ton range. So they removed a lot of monster nets from our ocean.
And it's one thing to pull them out once they're there. What is it that, if anything, that can be done to cut down on these going in?
You know, I have more answers about how to clean it up. And I would hope that the awareness that will, and education that will be generated in the cleanup will help on the issues of getting plastics in. I mean, this expedition, we were focusing on nets because this vessel is particularly uniquely, has a cargo hold to store them and the ability to get them out.
Right.
But even with that being said, probably 15 to 20% of what we came up with was consumer plastics. Because the consumer plastics get caught in the nets. And this vessel, if they weren't, they were so hardworking, if they weren't immediately seeing nets, but there were consumer plastics, they'd put their small boat in and they'd go and fill themselves up time and time again with the consumer plastics.
So then how does that work on the elimination of this? I mean, again, tons and tons. And yet I'm sure within that which is still there, that's a very small portion of that. How does that get eliminated, get cut down?
A large source of nets can be illegal fishing vessels. And I know the UN and many countries are working very hard on trying to track down and eliminate illegal fishing. You know, if they, it's a very lucrative business, this illegal fishing, and they're big vessels out there doing it. And if a plane or another vessel comes close to them, they'll cut their big nets because their vessel will be seized. And so that's one source. And another source is just smaller fishing vessels with small crews, and something gets caught or something gets tangled, and maybe they're in rough seas. And so for safety, they are, you know, just to be able to move on, they cut the net. So, I mean, those are kind of accidents, and there may be ways to figure out how to have better gear and avoid some of that. But cutting down on the illegal fishing, because, yes, this is a huge amount, but the good bad news is we do have the ability to go out there and to bring in significant amounts, which sort of gives the ocean a chance.
A chance to breathe. And you're going back out next year, yes?
Yes.
Mary Crowley, her group just back from cleanup mission to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. She's the founder and executive director of Ocean Voyages Institute, a nonprofit based in Sausalito, California. Many thanks for spending some time with us today.
Oh, it's very much my pleasure. I'd like to keep in touch with you as we do more here from Hawaii.
You bet. Aloha.
Aloha.
That is the program for today. Coming up tomorrow, South Korea is hosting veterans this weekend as we approach the 69th anniversary of the end of the Korean War, the armistice. We'll talk with the head of a delegation heading across the Pacific for some very special memorial ceremonies. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. If you want to hear today's show again, get a past show or links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Mahalo for spending some time with us. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine's back tomorrow when you can join us again for more of The Conversation.